Welcome to Political Rewind. It is 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you as usual live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. We hope you're listening to us here in Atlanta, in Albany, in Macon, in Savannah, in Athens, Augusta, all across the state. We have a terrific show lined up for you today. As always, if you want to join the conversation, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, and we'll try to work your tweets into the conversation. Joining us today is Christina Torres, a political reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We're really happy to have you here today, Christina. You're recovered from covering the state Senate in the General Assembly, I hope.
Probably not, but thank you for having me.
Sitting next to her, as I go from right to left, Jackie Cushman. She is the daughter of Newt Gingrich and has established herself as a respected conservative writer, columnist, blogger. Thanks for being back with us today, Jackie. Dr. Andra Gillespie, an Emory University Associate Professor of Political Science. Andra, always a pleasure to have you here. And joining us for the first time today, and we're glad to have her here, Julianne Thompson of the Free America Project. Before we get into the show, Julianne, welcome.
Thank you. Tell
our listeners about what the Free America Project is.
Well, the Free America Project is something that I founded about a year ago with the purpose of messaging to conservative grassroots organizers and the base of the conservative base of the Republican Party to try to build coalitions and bridges between the various factions in the GOP to unite behind a conservative.
Okay, well, thank you for that, and we look forward to hearing your thoughts as we move forward today. We're going to start by taking a look at what happened last night in Wisconsin, but I want to tell you, as we did in the opening of the show, that one of the reasons we have a panel of all women today is we want to talk about where women are coming down on many of the issues in the presidential campaign, and we'll get to that in the second segment of the show, but let's go right into talking about last night. Wisconsin, Christina, was not good to front runners last night. Ted Cruz beat Donald Trump soundly by like a dozen points. He even beat the expectations for the size of his victory that the pollsters had been suggesting he'd win by. And of course, Bernie Sanders soundly defeated Hillary Clinton as well. It was a big night.
Big night for both of them. I don't think it was unexpected. And I also have to wonder if you talk to Ted Cruz supporters and you talk to Bernie Sanders supporters, whether they would say, oh, yeah, front runners, you know, it's their delegates are only about what, roughly about 200 delegate difference.
230, I think, roughly.
And it's roughly around there for both both races. So it's, you know, Bernie Sanders feels he's got momentum. He's won the last, what, 7 out of 8? You know, but then we're going towards New York and Pennsylvania, places Hillary Clinton, I think, feels she can do very well. The same for Trump
exactly.
And Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things are remaining interesting.
So let's, I want to talk about each, the Republican side of that contest yesterday and the Democratic side. Let's start with Ted Cruz and his victory speech. Andra, I was fascinated by the fact that there were really similar themes between Ted Cruz's victory speech last night and Bernie Sanders' speech on the other side. We're going to hear a little of Ted Cruz, and I'll tell you what I meant by that. But first, here's Cruz.
3 weeks ago, the media said Wisconsin was a perfect state for Donald Trump. But the hardworking men and women of Wisconsin stood and campaigned tirelessly to make sure that tonight was a victory for every American. In the last 2 weeks, and in the coming days when Colorado and Wyoming finish voting, we are likely to have gained over 100 delegates on Donald Trump. As a result of the people of Wisconsin defying the media, defying the pundits, I am more and more convinced that our campaign is going to earn the 1,237 delegates needed to win the Republican nomination.
Ted Cruz last night. So what he went on to talk about was the fact that they've raised $2 million out of the last week of real in the last couple of weeks of this string of victories. With that in mind, let's just listen real quickly to Bernie Sanders, and then we'll talk about each of these races.
With our victory tonight in Wisconsin, we have now won 7 out of 8 of the last caucuses and primaries. And we have won almost all of them with overwhelming landslide numbers. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg, this is a campaign of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Here are the parallels. Both Cruz and Sanders said, we've won a lot in the last few elections, and they both, because Sanders goes on to do this too, talked about how much money they have been raising. So I find it interesting, those parallels there. What does Ted Cruz's victory in Wisconsin really mean from your point of view, Andra?
So I'm not quite sure yet if we know what it means. I think going into this, we realized that Sanders and Cruz were poised to be able to win, and that this, especially for Hillary Clinton, was going to be a psychological blow to her. Whether or not it actually affected the actual outcome of the primary season was up for grabs. You know, in the Republican case, what this does is this makes it harder for Donald Trump to be able to win the 1,237 delegates that he needs outright. So by some measurements, he would have to get 60% of the vote in all of the remaining primaries in order to be able to amass the delegates outright to be able to secure the nomination. So I think most people are now prepared for there to be some type of brokered convention going forward. I think what both Cruz and Sanders were doing was they were being very optimistic and very rosy in their expectations, but they were basically saying, we're here to stay and we're not going anywhere, and we've earned the right based on our votes and based on our fundraising to be here at the table.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting, Jackie, would it be fair to say that Ted Cruz is probably in a better position to in fact challenge for the Republican nomination, especially after last night, and with the caution that Andra gives us about moving forward, than Bernie Sanders, even though he's had a string of victories in the Democratic race?
Well, I think absolutely. But I think a couple of interesting things. First of all, if you listen to both of the candidates, you have Ted Cruz, who is, we can probably agree, he is definitely a, if you look at the four candidates, so he's on the far right. If you look at Bernie Sanders, he's on the far left. So you have the two kind of outside the middle candidates, both talking about how they appeal to people. The second thing that was fascinating is you listen to Ted Cruz, and he quoted the media as if they were factual, which since he has been always
Wait a minute.
You know, I'm just saying that was interesting to me that he referred back to the media, that when he's always saying, oh, they're all. So that I thought was fascinating. And then you have Bernie Sanders, who is at least this year, a Democrat as opposed to an independent, and he's quoting a Republican president. So I think it's all very interesting to watch. And if you look at the actual numbers, I mean, Cruz is only at 517. Trump is at 743 delegates. So I don't understand when Cruz says we can get to the delegates we need. I don't think he can get there. He can't get there mathematically.
Julianne, you're supporting Ted Cruz now. Uh-huh. And what's interesting about it, what he did say last night that I thought was particularly interesting was he said, we're going to go into the convention. We're going to get to 1237. And the crowd went crazy because at first he was suggesting he was going to get there during the primary season. But then he amended that and said, or we're going to get it at the convention.
Sure. And I don't think he's going to get there before the convention. I agree with Jackie on that. I look at the map and I just don't think that that's possible. But Wisconsin was pivotal for Republicans for a variety of reasons. Number one, it is a swing state, so it's telling of what can happen in the future with regard to the general election. And in the past 50 years, no Republican has ever clinched the nomination without winning Wisconsin. And there were 42 delegates at stake. And for all intents and purposes, even though there are, you know, some exceptions with regard to congressional district delegate allocations, for the most part, it was a winner-take-all state. And it was also an open primary state. And we know from the past that open primaries have been far more conducive to the Donald Trump.
Yeah, Trump has done well in open primary states.
And Ted Cruz has done much better in closed primaries. And if you look at the upcoming states, with a couple of exceptions, we have mostly closed primaries coming up. So I think Cruz is looking at the numbers from those closed primary states and the advantage he could have in those,
And I think he feels that he will get enough delegates to keep Donald Trump from getting to the 1237, and this will go to a contested convention. And also, given the states that are coming up, those are going to be the only two candidates that meet Rule 40, which is the 8-state majority.
Yeah, yeah. If Rule 40, by the way, if Rule 40 stays in effect at the Republican mm-hmm. convention, because as we pointed out on this show, the rules can all be voted on, changed and voted on again at the beginning of the convention. But, right, Rule 40 has been in place, and it would certainly eliminate John Kasich if it stays in effect, right?
Yes, and I'd like to say something about that. The delegation of the Republican National Convention was not very friendly to a lot of rule changes last time. We stopped Rule 16 from happening. That's a rules change that they tried to bring about. That would have, in the future, given the nominee the opportunity, or the presumptive nominee the opportunity to decide who delegates were going to be from states. We shut that down. Rule 40 passed, and the reason that it passed is there were just an overwhelming amount of people that were trying to stop Ron Paul.
Okay.
But it's turned around to bite them.
Right, exactly, exactly. Christina, you want to jump in?
Well, it's ironic because we're talking about closed primaries, open primaries. Bernie Sanders mm-hmm. has done very well in open primaries, mm-hmm. but we have these closed primaries come up where you have Hillary Clinton. So, you know, we talk about the distance and whether people can make it. Hillary seems to be cruising that way.
And I do think for Hillary, this is a bigger hit because, I mean, first of all, Hillary thought she should have won, you know, several cycles ago. Donald Trump has gotten into this race. My guess is he is probably surprised how far he has gone. To be perfectly frank, I think at this point he does want to secure the nomination. He does want to win the presidency. But he's not looking back as this is what he's worked for all his life. My guess is Hillary Clinton she's a very hard worker. She's worked very hard to get where she is. She's very disciplined, and I think for her, this has been a much longer, harder primary than she had anticipated, where for Trump, he probably wakes up every day just amazed he's still there. So that creates a lot of energy.
Andra, one of the phenomena, without regard to the fact that Julianne Thompson is a Trump supporter sitting next...
Cruz.
I meant Cruz.
That's okay.
You know... The strange phenomenon that certainly a lot of people are talking about today, particularly, is that many in the Republican establishment are sort of swallowing a bitter pill. I mean, you would not expect Ted Cruz to become the darling of the GOP establishment. And if you look at the exit polls last night, a lot of the votes for Ted Cruz were really about stopping Donald Trump. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about this is that he who has the second most votes kind of really has all the leverage in this case. And so, I mean, the reason why we're talking about Ted Cruz and not talking about John Kasich is that Ted Cruz has demonstrated an ability to be able to get votes and to come in at least second place often. Kasich hasn't demonstrated that. And so if the goal is to try to prevent Donald Trump from being president in a way that is not going to offend the Republican Party electorate by changing the rules midstream and looking like you're kind of rigging it to keep him out, then you have to go with Cruz. And so, you know, this still leaves the moderates kind of shut out. Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things about last night was that moderates broke for Donald Trump as opposed to Ted Cruz. So I think the moderate Republicans are still trying to figure out where exactly they're going to go. But if you want some legitimacy to trying to stop Donald Trump, then Ted Cruz is the one who actually has the votes to actually look legitimate.
You know, go ahead, Jackie.
I think it's fascinating if you look at Ted Cruz, because he was, if you think about how he's kind of transitioned through this race, he was the U.S. senator who ran as an outsider, even though he was inside Washington, who then now, because of where he is in the race, originally he was worried, I'm sure, about Jeb Bush, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're Ted Cruz and you're running in this race, originally you're worried about Bush. So you have Trump, you have Bush, Bush goes away. So now he's now running on the establishment side, right? So he is the insider, I guess, candidate, which I think is a little confusing, but he seems to be able to, you know, change into whatever he needs to be. But it's really fascinating.
But I think the big question is, how does he change, if he changes at all, as a result of this? So is he going to moderate his stance? Is he now going to position himself as being somebody who knows how to cooperate with people or play well? You know, Donald Trump has outpopulist him. And so if he's kind of, you know, kind of been played on the populist flank, then he needs to figure out sort of exactly what his lane is and what his courageous conservatism actually stands
Julianne,
for.
Julianne, what do you think about that?
I don't think he's been as much of a pop, that Cruz has been as much of a populist as he has been an ideologue. Hmm. And I don't think that you've seen him change that right. or change any of his issues or his viewpoints. And I think that the reason that so many people trust him is because he is an outsider and he did go to Washington,
D.C. You mean why voters trust him?
Yes, okay. Why voters trust him is because he did go to Washington, D.C. and he kept his promises even when he had to buck up against his own party to do it. And people admire that and consider him to be an outsider just as much as Donald Trump, who is running on the fact that he's never held political office before. So, I mean, yes, Donald Trump is appealing to more of the populist movement, but I still feel that Ted Cruz is appealing to more ideologues, and I believe that the Republican establishment is backing him for one reason and one reason only, and that's to stop Trump.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. I think they want to stop Trump. I think the challenge you're going to have in a general election, if you end up with a Ted Cruz who clearly is on the far on the right, especially if you look at the national mm-hmm. spectrum on the much farther right, and Hillary she is definitely more moderate. I think it becomes a much stronger battle for. I mean, I think Hillary in that case. Can really gather some momentum. But if you look in the end, if you either have a Trump or, I mean, if somehow Kasich, you're in Ohio, you never know what's going to happen. And even though Kasich's been around a long time, I mean, he is no establishment, you know, he has no love with the establishment because Kasich does what Kasich wants. Kasich yeah. does what he thinks is right. Kasich is very pragmatic, whereas Ted Cruz will stand on the Senate floor and pontificate and filibuster. John Kasich works across the aisle to actually accomplish things and get things done. So I think it would be a much different matchup if you had a John Kasich who was very mm-hmm. much toward the center, who could talk
right.
about getting things done.
Right, he was sort of the moderate choice
versus exactly.
Trump or right. Cruz.
You know,
Kasich's fading, so... You know, what do you do?
Christina, I was watching the morning shows this morning, flipping around, whether you're watching Morning Joe or watching Fox in the morning, nobody's very happy with their candidates. I mean, you know, Joe Scarborough was arguing this morning, Ted Cruz will never be the nominee of the Republican Party. The folks at Fox don't like Trump. They're not that crazy about Ted Cruz either, I don't really think. This is the election in which no one is happy.
Which, I mean, if you're a voter, that's so exciting. You get to see this play out, and hopefully, and we can argue about this, the candidates are actually telling you what they think they're going to do or telling you what they mean versus sort of the sort of glitzy marketing that the party wants you to hear.
Right.
I think that's exciting. And, you know, turnout can go up. That might be a great thing.
No, we've got a tweet from Noah McGahey, who says, if Cruz can have landslides in all the remaining races, he might be able to win the nomination. But boy, Julianne, he's got quite an obstacle ahead of him
to
do that.
Yeah, I think it's somewhere around 80% that he would have to win to get the nomination between now and the convention. It's a huge barricade for him, but I still think that he can get to a contested convention given what happened in Wisconsin. And just to go back to what Christina said just a second ago, insurgency isn't something, as we know from last night, it's not something that's exclusive to Republicans. Democrats are facing the same exact issue. People are tired of the status quo. And that's, I believe, why you saw the same, you know, similarities in the speeches between Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz, even though ideologically they're polar opposite.
Yeah, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Andre, the question that we're going to, and we'll probably address this even more in the next segment of the show, but let's start it now. Donald Trump, I don't think anyone disagrees, had a really bad couple of weeks mm-hmm. leading up to the vote in Wisconsin yesterday. And it is certainly true that Wisconsin should have been a perfect place for him to pretty much secure the nomination. The state was really set for him. Are we going to see, we talk about, well, he'll have New York, New Jersey, friendlier ground, but do we imagine that some of the things that happened with him in the last week or so are going to have an impact in the states that are supposedly his home turf?
So, I mean, I think the issue or the problem is looking at Wisconsin versus looking at some of the national polls. And so we haven't seen that evidence yet that Trump has been penalized nationally for all of his shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm hesitant at this point to say that, you know, the flip-flop on abortion and the fight over the wives has actually had a negative effect on him yet until unless the other data points. And so right now, Wisconsin is just one data point. So I think as we have more primaries, we will actually see whether or not Trump really is losing steam and look at some of the national polls in order to be able to tell whether or not we really have turned a corner yet. And I think we're all probably a little skittish about predictions at this point because we've made so many of them this cycle and just been wrong.
If you look at the polls, Trump was not ahead since the middle of February in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So he hasn't been. He wasn't expected. I mean, it's been a long time, okay?
But late-breaking voters went for Cruz by even bigger numbers
last week. Right. But I will say, to Andre's point, but to your point, I think we have seen a whole campaign of blunders.
Right.
So I don't think it's just happened this past week.
Right.
I mean, he's had blunder after blunder this entire campaign. And for some reason, which I don't understand, he's managed to get away with things that no other candidate on either side could ever have gotten away with.
Right.
So I think you're exactly right, and we have to hold off judgment because he seems to have Teflon to some degree. He says, you know, radical things that are kind of bizarre, and it's fine.
So, I mean, and one of the things to point out in the exit polls was that if you made your decision that day, and that could have also been in Wisconsin because they have same-day registration.
Right.
You could have also just shown up to vote that day. Those folks broke for Trump.
They did?
Yeah.
I got that wrong.
And one of the things that has always kind of struck me is field operations. So, I mean, I think this was Trump's problem in Iowa. He didn't know how to run a campaign and didn't think you had to run a campaign conventionally. And Ted Cruz ran the drill the way you're supposed to run the drill. And just based on the rhetoric, I would assume that in Wisconsin, they were running the drill and had been there campaigning, that their field operations were in place. And so this might be the place where the rubber hits the road, where Trump's resistance to professional campaigning actually ends up coming back to reckon with him for not doing the things that he needs to do.
So thank you for adding that layer of information about the last day, because the exit polling I saw was that among people who decided in the last week, they broke for Cruz.
Yes.
But the very latest breaking voters went for Trump. Yep. Very interesting.
Yeah, I had heard that they broke for Cruz as well. And I think that the gaffes that he's had over the past couple of weeks, whether it is the arrest of his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, whether it is the situation with the wives, I think the abortion issue, I don't think anybody really cares about his flip-flop on that, because there's been so many flip-flops over time that people, I don't think
they've lost track.
I don't think they're looking at it, and I don't think that they care. But I think that there's something within most men. And he gets a lot of his support from men. But there's something in most men, when you start attacking wives, they get protective. And I've heard so many men that were supporters of Trump say, you know, I'm starting to think twice about him now, because things that people are saying about him, you know, the ugliness is really starting to show. And you want to say, well, it hasn't showed to you so far. You haven't seen it so far. And, you know, I just think that because he has said so many things that have been bombastic in the past, that people have been excited about because they're so sick of being held captive by the speech police. I think that they feel like when you start attacking wives, when you start attacking the families, you've gone a step too far. But like what Jackie said, he's had a lot of gaffes, and he seems to get a bump in the polls with every gaffe.
Well, I think part of what he tries to make his appeal be is that what you see is what you get. What
sure.
I say is honest. I'm being direct with you. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no speech police after me. I'm not going to say what the party wants me to say. That's my appeal. And it works to a degree. Certainly, we look at the folks who voted for him so far.
One last question, then we're going to take a break. Julianne, you are the one person sitting at this table right now, to the best of my knowledge, who could have a role in the Republican convention in Cleveland in July. Is Trump an embarrassment to the Republican Party at this point?
I think that there have certainly been things that I would have changed about his candidacy and things that he have said. I wouldn't have advised him if I were his communications director to conduct himself the way that he has. But I think
I think that their
motto within the Trump campaign is let Trump be Trump. That is their motto. And he likes to have control over his campaign just like he does his businesses.
But from your point of view.
From my point of view, I really am hesitant to say too many negative things before we get into the national convention, because I do want to be fair. I do want to be able, if I am bound a certain way as far as who I vote for in the first and second round, I am going to be fair to that person.
Gotcha. Okay, makes sense. Look, let's take a break. It's just after 2:30 on Wednesday afternoon. When we come back, let's talk about women and the 2016 presidential race. This is Political Rewind.
You told us less is more. So this spring at GPB, we're trying something new. As soon as we hit the goal for our spring membership campaign, we are done. It's over. The more listeners we hear from before the drive starts, the sooner we're going to get there. Can we cut a day or two off the drive? Even more? Let's do this. With your contribution right now, you'll also enter to win a St. Simons Island getaway for two with three nights at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. Go to gpb.org and click donate, and thanks.
After the city of Charlotte passed an ordinance banning discrimination against LGBT people, the North Carolina State Legislature called a special session and passed a bill overruling Charlotte's new law. On the next Fresh Air, how preemption by state legislatures is overruling many local laws, from fracking bans to paid sick leave. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. I'm here with Christina Torres of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim Galloway, by the way, is on vacation. Have you taken a vacation yet?
Next week.
Oh, okay. Good. Glad to hear it. Jackie Cushman is with us. Julianne Thompson and Andra Gillespie. We're at Politics GPB, if you want to reach us on the Twitter. One big dog fan tweeted, "Are there any rumors floating around of possible running mates for the front runners? I think we're going to hold off on that excitement for another time." Not quite. Although, Andra, there are people who are starting to say the only way that the younger Bernie Sanders people are going to come to Hillary Clinton is if she makes him the vice presidential running mate. That would be strange.
So one of my friends sent me a political article last week that said Al Franken might.
Yeah, that's right. Franken has in fact come to the surface.
And so, wow. and the argument was actually pretty compelling and very intriguing. So,
what's the argument? Do you remember what the argument is? I read a couple of articles.
Lots of things. But the entertainment background of it's Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, he's been a workhorse in the Senate. He is sufficiently progressive to attract Bernie supporters, even the fact that, and I didn't realize this, he's shorter than Hillary Clinton.
That's probably good, right?
Right, and that ends up working out. It was so fascinating.
He might start wearing boots. He might go to Marcos.
So I will tell a quick story because I like to reach into the past. The first time I met Al Franken was the 1988 presidential race. We were out on the road, and he was working at that point, I guess, for Saturday Night Live, and Al was pretending to be a journalist, and he went around with he'd fashioned a little tiny satellite dish out of aluminum foil, and he wore it on his head. That's how far Senator Al Franken has come since those days. So let's talk with all of you about how are women voters dealing with this entire election cycle? I talked to Jackie Cushman the other day and said, I really want to do this subject. I think we should have an all-female panel to do it. And Jackie slammed me right away. Tell me why I should be careful about how we talk about this.
Well, I think when you put any group of people into one box and want to talk about them as a group, I think it becomes very problematic, whether it's male, female, black, white, you know, based on religion. But you know, if you have groups of people to stereotype them in one way, I think is very disconcerting.
And I agreed with that. Can I, Julianne, though, say that there are issues, not that women all agree with, but that have appealed to various women, depending on their philosophies, differently than they do to men? Would that be a fair thing to say?
I think it's a fair thing to say in the past. I don't think it's a fair thing this election cycle. There's never been an election in my lifetime when national security has been on the forefront of everyone's mind, men and women, as it has been in 2016. And women are speaking pretty loudly, saying, you know, I'm not defined by my gender. I'm not defined by my uterus. I care about a lot more than just abortion and birth control. So let's talk about the major issues, because I care about the same things as my husband and other men.
Okay.
So we know there's a diversifying electorate, right? It's getting increasingly more diverse. You're seeing that in the campaigns, or who they're trying to appeal to, what they say, you know, trying out some speech here, then going somewhere else and trying out another idea there. And I think this is part of it. I admittedly agree with Jackie. So go girl. I'm Latino. You can't say all Latinos feel the same because we're incredibly diverse.
Okay, that's fine. On the other hand, if you want to put it in that context, we do say about Latinos, as people talk about women voters, we do say about Latinos, what are Republicans doing to reach out to the Latino voter? Donald Trump is scaring the Latino voter away from the Republican Party. So while we understand that there isn't going to be unanimity on issues based on gender, on ethnic background or whatever, aren't there some commonalities that are worth talking about?
There might be. There might be. But okay. by the same token, I mean, so are you going to appeal to someone who's Mexican-American, whose family's been here six generations, versus some family from, let's say, Miami, who's from Cuba?
Fair enough. Right. Okay, wait. Right. Andra Gillespie, you are the political scientist in this room. Tell me what I'm getting wrong here.
So I think it's a both and. I don't think it's an either or. So, yes, no group is a monolith. And so I think we have to acknowledge that as we talk about that. However, there are trends. And so, you know, for African Americans, who I study all the time and happen to be a member of that group, we can't ignore the fact that they vote 90% Democratic. And so there are a multiplicity of reasons why that happens. So not all blacks are voting Democratic for the same reasons, but we would be remiss to not note that trend, or the nearly 75% of Latinos and Asian Americans who, you know, in 2012 voted for Barack Obama. With women, it's never been that cut, that straightforward. So, you know, when women first got the right to vote, for the longest time, people thought that, well, women would just do whatever their husbands and fathers did. And then we started to notice that women tended to vote more Democratic than their male counterparts. So that's how we, you know, birthed the notion of the gender gap. But the gender gaps that we're talking about still have substantial divisions between women. And so you can't say that we're all a monolith because of our gender identity. But what we do know and what we have seen in the last 10 to 15 years is that there are differences when we compound gender with other identities. So marital status, for instance, race, where we do see huge variations. So it was during, you know, people thought the gender gap was going away in the mid-2000s with George W. Bush. And then people started to notice that, married women and single women tend to vote differently. And so there's a huge gender gap when you start to look at single women. And so you had the security moms of 2004, and then you have your single women who are disproportionately of color who care about other issues. So they care about civil rights. They care about, you know, wage inequality and other types of issues.
All right. So all that said.
Well said, by the way.
All that said, and it was what, that's what.
I know.
That's why she's on this show.
Giving her a shout out on the air. Come on.
All that said, what do we all make of these two comments that Hillary Clinton is, in one case she made it once, in the other it's been frequently repeated. Let's listen to her.
Don't you someday want to see a woman president of the United States of America?
Senator Sanders is the only person who I think would characterize me, a woman running to be the first woman president, as exemplifying the establishment.
Jackie, Hillary Clinton and her campaign have been accused over and over and over again of playing the gender card.
Well, I think when you stand up and say, wouldn't you like to see a woman in office? I mean, what else do you want to call that? I mean, she clearly is saying you should vote for me. And I think we will have a woman president, whether it's Hillary Clinton or somebody in the near, I think in the near future, we will see a woman president. But I think we also need to be very careful about appealing to someone because of their sex, regardless of their qualifications or what they believe. I do think secondarily, what's so interesting is if you look at both parties, you have Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and then you have Trump and Cruz, and Hillary clearly is the establishment. I mean, regardless of gender. I mean, it is. I mean, she's been around politics forever. Mm-hmm. That's why she clearly has dominated this cycle. She has a lot of experience. She's been a U.S. senator. I mean, she's done lots of things, and she is establishment. But if you look at the Republican side, they really have no. I mean, Ted Cruz is, you know, quote, the establishment candidate, but he's not really an establishment candidate.
No,
exactly. So they don't really have. They're trying to figure out what's my best choice, when really clearly on the Democratic side it's Hillary Clinton.
Okay, so I intentionally started with Clinton-Sanders. Because we have a female candidate, we'll get to the Republicans, because there, I think there are people who would say there have been some egregious statements made that women as a group might take issue with, although we'll let you comment on that. Of course, there's the famous Madeleine Albright remark.
Don't you someday want to see a woman president of the United States of America?
You can tell our story about how we climbed the ladder, and a lot of you younger women don't think you have to. It's been done. It's not done. And you have to help. Hillary Clinton will always be there for you. And just remember, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other.
Christina, Oh, my goodness. They took a lot of flack. Although Madeleine Albright had been saying that, we learned later, for years.
And it was,
to be fair, it was changed. What Madeleine Albright said, there's a special place in hell for women who don't support women. She didn't say Clinton specifically. No. So what?
Well,
it got translated.
Certainly, Madeleine Albright, you talk about experience and whose credentials,
absolutely.
You know, you certainly don't question. You know, I'm thinking of the millennial who probably honestly doesn't maybe know who Madeleine Albright is. Mm. In terms of appeal. That said, it's hard to comment on that, on her statement, because obviously you can take it any way, including as being offended to say, well, I support Bernie Sanders. Why am I going to hell?
Well, what did you think of that comment?
I thought it was just the typical politics of shame. I think if things aren't going your way, you start shaming people. And Hillary has had a background of every time anyone questions her on her policy, her issues, or her record, she cries misogyny. And whether she is saying it to Republicans or whether, you know, it's Madeleine Albright trying to shame millennial women because they're not out in support of Hillary Clinton, it's the same thing.
Okay. Here's what's very interesting, and none of you at this table will be surprised by this, but here are some remarks from young women on a college campus about Hillary Clinton as a candidate.
I also am a woman. I also face discrimination as being a woman. Her feminism does not represent my feminism, and I think that's really important to differentiate that. It's like, I think you have to realize that, you know, everybody's human, and like, you have to go for who has the best ideals, and just because she's a woman doesn't necessarily make her the best candidate.
Andra?
So, I mean, this is a classic fight between second wave feminists and then those who came after. So, Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Gloria Steinem, when she said that, you know, all the Bernie supporters were just going there because boys were there.
Yeah.
you know, very much represent a certain type of second wave feminism from the, you know, mid-60s to the mid-1970s that has been strongly critiqued on many fronts for lots of reasons. So women of color critique them because they were largely left out of that story. Women who were not affluent were left out of that story because the type of feminism that they were seeking to realize was the type of stuff that I need to break into professional careers, and there were other women who were just trying to survive. Mm-hmm. And then younger women who don't necessarily practice their feminism in the same way obviously have benefited from it, recognize that they've benefited from what their mothers have done ahead of them, but they just don't see the fight and perhaps the identity politics in the same way, and they bristle against being told that they need to behave in a particular way as a result of that.
Yeah, and I think because of that, I think you've got a very good point. I think because they have a different perspective of the world because of their age, they don't feel like they have to go and pay for the what's happened in the past, right? So this is a new world. They have a different view of what's happening today, and they're looking forward, and they're not saying that because of what you've done in the past, I owe you for that.
And they just don't have, they might not view Clinton as the standard bearer necessarily. I'm sure a lot of these young women would love to see a female president and could perhaps be mobilized on that dimension. But if they don't like this particular candidate and they don't like how she's selling herself, then that ends up being a problem for her. I mean, I think Clinton's problem is that there are lots of problems. But one of Clinton's problems is that she takes her qualifications for granted and assumes that because she is on paper perhaps the most qualified in the race, that therefore people should be flocking to her. And campaigning and politics is as much of an art as it is a science. And so you need more than just that in order to be able to develop a national appeal.
Do we imagine that how do we imagine a general election campaign in which Hillary Clinton is the nominee, if women are not, cannot be stereotyped as all going in the same direction, which is certainly true, I get that. What do we think her impact will be among women voters facing either a Donald Trump or a Ted Cruz or some unknown player to be traded later?
Right. And the way things look right now, it's going to be Hillary. But there's always the chance that the closer that we get to the Democratic National Convention, that some of those superdelegates could flip, just like they did from Hillary to Barack Obama in 2012. We don't know for sure that she's going to be the nominee as of yet. But I think it's going to be difficult, depending on who we put forward. I think that the Democrats certainly, if the nominee would say as Donald Trump, I think the Democrats certainly have all of their sound bites readily prepared mm-hmm. to use in their campaign against him. But, you know, that being said, there are a lot of things that I'm sure Republicans are prepared to use against Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders if they're the nominee.
Yeah, both the New York Times and the Washington Post had pieces on just that this past week that the Clinton people are expecting if Donald Trump is the nominee. They already have a pretty good idea what his playbook's going to be all about.
Yes.
And it will include, we assume, attacking her. If not directly, using language that suggests that there are traits of women that would not make her a powerful president, I think. You know, she doesn't have stamina. He's already talked about that.
And
for instance,
I think that's the oddest, because of all the things Hillary Clinton is, she's a very hard worker.
That's
you can disagree with her politically or not like her policies, but she's a very hard worker. Mm-hmm. She's very smart. But she gave the interview that came up today. Glenn Thrush interviewed her, and it came out this morning. And there are a couple of things that I thought were fascinating. One is she talked about that she's not a natural politician. I mean, I think we'd all agree that she's not a natural politician. She doesn't. You can tell she doesn't like to be
up
there.
Yeah, you can see it when she's up
on
the stage
or
speaking.
It's hard for her. She's not a Barack Obama or a Bill Clinton. The other thing is, and she then actually says, and I'm going to quote, she goes, from the literature I've seen, it may be gender-linked. Her not being...
Well, this is exactly what Julianne is saying. Right?
Well, wait, don't you think there's... Let's start at the foundation, and I'm not defending.
Right.
I'm just trying to think about it more academically. At the foundation where she's coming from, we talked about the second wave feminists, you know, given where she started, where she is now, in terms of being called shrill, strident, all those things that women, I think of all ages, understand to be sort of that sort of indirect insult to your gender. And then coming into now, where you do have the young folks saying, you know, young women saying, well... You know, we've moved on from that. We get where that's coming from, but that doesn't define me. It doesn't define my view. I mean, I think you can look at it but that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then she did go on to clarify that's because she's not used to talking about herself, but used to supporting other candidates in other positions. But that transition... So, Andra, I'd love to hear your comment.
So, I mean, Hillary Clinton's problem, and this is not a gender problem, but this is Hillary Clinton's problem, is that she tries to have it both ways, and it sometimes backfires on her. So, think in 2008 when Gloria Steinem got in trouble, for supporting Clinton over Obama and basically cited her service as first lady as being, you know, qualifying her to be president of the United States. And people had to point out, whoa, so that's a privilege that you got by being married to somebody. In any other circumstance, we would never use our husband's backgrounds or qualifications to justify, you know, us getting a job for anything else. And so, and I think that that's, you know, that's part of the problem of her perhaps being the first female president of the United States that I think we have to contend with. And then kind of going back and forth and saying, oh, I'm not a natural politician. Yes, you do have the misfortune of being married to Bill Clinton, who is the greatest natural politician in the world. But just like she can't have it both ways. And so there are times when she's kind of going back and forth by saying, oh, it's my gender. And it's like, no, it might be you. And
I'm sorry, because we don't, run short on time, and I want to transition to the Republicans. We all know that Donald Trump, throughout his campaign, has made remarks that I would assume many, many women, regardless of ideology, have had problems with. And this was the ad that I'm sure some of you have heard, and I'm going to play it in its entirety. The anti-Trump ad with women actors, using some of the language that Trump has used.
Bimbo, dog, fat pig. Real quotes from Donald Trump about women. A person who is very flat-chested is very hard to be a 10.
I'd look her right in that fat, ugly face of hers.
Look at that face. Would anyone vote for that?
She had the height. She had the beauty. She was crazy. But these are minor details.
I like kids. I mean... I won't do anything to take care of them. I'll supply funds, and she'll take care of the kids.
You know, it really doesn't matter what they write, as long as you've got a young and beautiful piece of ass.
That must be a pretty picture, you dropping to your knees.
There was blood coming out of her eyes. Blood coming out of her... wherever.
Women, you have to treat them like shit.
This is how Donald Trump talks about our mothers, our sisters,
our daughters.
So, Julianne, I asked you before, and you were very diplomatic, and we give you that, whether Trump was an embarrassment for Republicans, regardless of whether you want to characterize it that way or not. These are not the words you want your nominee for the White House to be using, yes?
No, these are certainly insulting terms. I think a lot of these a lot of these things he said before the election. That doesn't make them any better, but they're insulting terms. And going back to what you said before, I think if Donald Trump goes down the road of trying to trace Hillary Clinton's qualifications to becoming president, tries to trace that to her gender or any type of physical insult, I think that that's going to backfire on him big time. And unfortunately, I think that that he just does not have the discipline to keep his mouth shut when he should.
Yeah. Christina, you know, Trump's problems are pretty big in this regard. The unfavorability ratings on him, if you look at any of the polls lately in terms mm-hmm. of women voters, they're upwards, in some cases, upwards of 70%+. How can you become elected president if you have 70%? And unfavorability ratings aren't the sort of thing you say, oh, well, I've got a way to turn those around. Those are hard to turn around. How do you win the White House without women?
I think we're about to find out if he can. You know, it's now not about watching polls, really. It's about delegate counting.
Yeah. I mean, and it's also he has had high unfavorables the entire time he's been running, and yet he still managed to win. And so I think it becomes a question of, you know, do women voters defect enough? And actually, historically, in the primaries, they haven't. Most of the time, Trump actually wins the plurality of women
yes,
voters.
He does. Well, yes, he does.
I mean, Virginia, right. You know, Virginia, North Carolina, Missouri are exceptions to that. But, you know, aside from places where he just outright loses the contest itself. But, I mean, there are still women who vote for him. And I think we need to figure out why.
Well, I think the question becomes, and if you think about, I mean, if you even look at the evangelicals who went and went ahead and went for Trump, right? And you would think they would be naturally Cruz supporters, mm-hmm. but they didn't. They endorsed Trump. And if you listen to why they said that, I'm going to paraphrase, it's because he was the standard, he'd be our standard bearer. We don't like him, you know, but it's not about him being, you know, right with, it's him being in front of us, right, protecting us. So I think there is this disconnect that we don't normally see between do we like him, right, as in do we want to sit next to them and be friends, or do we at least trust him enough so that he can go out there and protect us, which I think is a very different mm-hmm. question. And especially if he becomes a nominee against Hillary Clinton, who is neither liked nor trusted, I think it becomes very fascinating.
I think, yeah. Julianne, you know, it's interesting the point that Andra raises. The answer is that when you listen to interviews with women who vote for Trump, they say, yeah, we know all these bad things about him, but you know what? We think he's strong and he's going to be mm-hmm. decisive as president.
That's right. And they view him with great strength, and they're tired of America as being viewed as weak in the world. And they want somebody that has a very strong voice, who is powerful, who can negotiate. And, I mean, he definitely frames himself as the master negotiator. I think that all along we have been framing this election as something that has been based on anger. And I think that that's partially true. But I think that you can frame it more as people that are desperate. And I think that desperation is what's driving a lot of women to vote for someone that they ordinarily wouldn't want to.
Let's do this. I mean, we're going to be talking about Trump in this for a long time. Before we run out of time completely, I want to also take a couple minutes to talk about Ted Cruz and women. Here's another soundbite that got a lot of play at the time he said it, but it's worth discussing right now.
When the war on women came up, Republicans would curl up in a ball. They'd say, don't hurt me. Jiminy Cricket, this is a made-up nonsense example. Last I checked, we don't have a rubber shortage in America. Look, when I was in college, we had a machine in the bathroom. You put 50 cents in and voila. So yes, anyone who wants contraceptives can access them, but it's an utterly made-up nonsense issue.
I thought everybody knew this soundbite. Julianne, I think you did, but I see Andra Gillespie, Jackie Cushman, and Christina Torres sitting here like, oh my gosh.
I hadn't heard it before, I'll be honest.
I haven't either.
So yeah. This was his response to all the Planned Parenthood and mm-hmm. Republicans are against women. But that kind of talk, Andra, I mean, I get that abortion is a hot button issue and there are many people on both sides of it, but this is not the way to appeal to women voters, it seems to me.
Absolutely. I mean, and Ted Cruz has this other problem. So I'm going to write about this. It's about his lack of swagger. And so he's too busy trying to be cool, and he overdid it.
That's my problem, too.
Yeah, no.
Oh, no, you have
swagger.
Cool.
Yeah, you're much cooler than that. So, I mean, I think that this is a problem. What he can't ignore is, I remember when I was working in D.C. for a Democratic pollster in 2004, I remembered we'd go through clients, and they would bring up issues like contraception and abortion more so at the time. And I was like, why are you talking about this now? Because I figured by 2004, this was actually pretty much a settled deal. And now, having gone through the 12 cycle and the war on women and the comments about intentional rape and unintentional rape, like, no, I mean, I think the Republicans really have to realize that this is a problem, and that contraception and reproductive health care is much bigger than abortion, and it's much bigger than contraception.
Yeah, Julianne,
as well.
Given the chance, do you want to pull your candidate aside and have a little conversation with him about the way he needs
to
talk about this?
I want to pull the entire Republican Party aside and talk to them about this, mainly because when we started talking about the war on women, we sent Karl Rove out to do the talking. We've got all these fantastic, strong women within the Republican Party that we could have put on camera to talk about it and to dispel the myths, but we didn't. And I think when it comes to messaging, we've done a very poor job when it comes to women.
It is interesting that when Donald Trump, we're not going to play his abortion comments because Julianne's right. He's reversed himself so many times and nobody knows where he stands. But it is interesting when he made his comments about women should be punished, it was pro-life and pro-women's groups who said, this is wrong. I think voters, Christine and Jackie, they all stood up, women voters, and said, you can't talk this way. So you got to be careful about how you talk about women and reproductive health.
Well, I think you have to be careful. I think one of the mistakes that both Trump and clearly Cruz made in that clip is that I think you have to be thoughtful. And I think to come across as glib if you're trying to have more swagger, I think that is very insulting to women, regardless of your stance. And I think you can have a thoughtful stance that might be different from a woman's, but if you treat it thoughtfully, it's different than being glib and offhand.
All right. I have got to stop the conversation because we didn't even get, I wanted very much to talk about the new religious liberty battle that is being waged across the South, North Carolina, Mississippi, certainly it's still ongoing in Georgia. You were all so interesting talking about this subject that we've dealt with today. We're going to have to defer that. We'll do it on Friday. In fact, we'll make it the lead of Friday's show unless something really exceptional happens. So I hope our listeners will be back for that. But Andra Gillespie, Julianne Thompson, Christina Torres, Jackie Cushman, it was a pleasure to have you all here. Thanks for educating me on how I need to talk about women and the 2016 election. Just a couple of program notes. You really can follow us at PoliticsGPB on Twitter. And the conversation goes on, whether we're on the air or not. So let us know what you're thinking about, and we will do our best to respond to everything you have to say and start a dialogue. The other quick thing I want to mention to you is that we're starting something new with the Carter Presidential Library next week. And although it's for our show Two-Way Street, we are going to be recording a two-way street in front of a live audience at the Carter Center on next Tuesday, April 12th. It's with Randall Wood. He has written a new history of LBJ and programs of the Great Society called Prisoners of Hope, in which he talks about the fact that all of the great promises that Lyndon Johnson put in place have had they've all ended up creating even more problems around them. If you'd like to be with us, you can just come to the Carter Presidential Library. We start at 7. It's a fairly small space, so try to get there a little bit early. You can be with us for the recording of a two-way street. I hope to see you there. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back on Friday on Political Rewind.